This episode features discussion of kidnapping and extreme violence that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13.
The nine men sat tied up on the beds, shivering in their underwear. They were cold, but they were also terrified.
One of their friends, Yosef Romano, lay dead on the floor in front of them, his blood soaking into the carpet.
They couldn't avoid looking at his mutilated body unless they closed their eyes, but even then the smell was unavoidable.
Outside the door, two terrorists with machine guns stood guard. Not that there was any way the men could escape.
They'd been trapped in here for hours. Even if the police tried to rescue them, they could easily be shot and killed in the ambush, or their captors could mow them down at the first sign of a rescue attempt.
All they could do was sit and wait, hoping that the negotiations happening outside would set them free.
This is Hostage, the new Parcast podcast telling the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We also cover the psychological tactics used in hostage negotiations and what the human brain does when held captive. I'm Carter Roy.
And I'm Irma Blanco. You can listen to all of Parcast shows on your favorite podcast directory. New episodes come out every Thursday. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you listen.
This is our final episode on the kidnapping of 11 members of the Israeli Olympic team by Black September at the 1972 Munich Olympics, an event known as the Munich Massacre.
In the early hours of September 5th, 1972, 11 Israeli athletes, coaches, and Olympic officials were taken hostage by 8 commandos from the Palestinian terrorist group known as Black September. The ensuing standoff lasted for nearly 24 hours, with the whole world watching as the German authorities tried to negotiate the Israelis' release.
Last week, we followed the Israeli Olympic team and Black September through the dramatic events surrounding the initial ambush.
This week, we'll track the tense negotiations between Issa, the leader of the Black September team, and the German authorities, broadcast on live television around the world. We'll look at the tragic resolution less than a day later and see how the repercussions still reverberate today.
Shortly after 4:30 a.m. on September 5th, 1972, the Munich Olympics, touted as the Games of Peace and Joy, became the Games of Terror.
Black September's primary goal was to raise the profile of the plight of the Palestinian Arabs, who'd been living as refugees for nearly a quarter century. Black September wanted to reaffirm their community's existence after decades of exile, at a moment when they felt like the world no longer cared about them. The world stage offered by the Olympics provided the perfect venue.
By 5 a.m., the Olympic and German authorities knew something was wrong. The terrorists had already killed 2 hostages, and a very public standoff was about to begin.
Despite the prevalence of politically motivated terror attacks in the early 1970s, both the Bavarian and Olympic authorities were caught off guard. The security guards and police officers patrolling the Olympic Village had no weapons, in a move to replace the world's vision of Germany's Nazi past with a more positive and welcoming impression.
But even worse, neither the West German federal government nor the Bavarian state government had an anti-terror unit or a hostage negotiation team. The world, including both Palestinians and Israelis, believed a myth of ruthless German efficiency, assuming that the West Germans had taken all necessary security precautions in planning for the Olympics. But it was just that, a myth.
As soon as word got out that shots had been fired in the Olympic Village and masked men had broken into the Israeli team's apartments, the Germans frantically scrambled.
While someone wakened Manfred Schreiber, the Munich chief of police, another officer returned to the Olympic Village housing at 31 Connollystrasse. Spotting the officer outside, Issa dropped 2 papers from the second floor window.
The papers, typed in advance, stated the terrorist demands that Israel release 232 fedayeen, or fighters for the Palestinian cause, from Israeli jails, as well as the leader of the German Bader-Meinhof terrorist group, who were being held in German prisons. If the fighters weren't released by 9 a.m., the Black September team would start executing its hostages.
The Munich police officers didn't know who Black September were and had no idea how serious the demands and threats were. A more senior officer went to check it out.
Feeling that he and his team weren't being taken seriously, Issa had the body of Moshe Weinberg, who'd been killed in the initial attack, thrown out onto the pedestrian street for the police officer to see.
With this, the German officials realized the magnitude of the situation they were dealing with. At 5:30 a.m., the Red Cross came to collect Weinberg's body, and Munich Police Chief Schreiber arrived on the scene with armed officers.
In the meantime, all the terrorists and hostages inside 31 Connolly Strasse could do was wait.
Once the Black September team knew the authorities were aware of them, they'd hunkered down. Their commanders had done their research and told the team not to let the situation last more than 24 hours. Anything longer, they said, would be too psychologically taxing, and they'd already been awake through the night.
They kept their Israeli captives locked up in one of the bedrooms on the second floor of the apartment. Yosef Gutfreund, the hulking wrestling referee, was tied to a chair, while the other eight men, Andre Spitzer, Kehat Shor, Yaakov Springer, Amitzer Shapira, Zeev Friedman, Eliezer Helfin, David Berger, and Mark Slavin, were sitting on the room's two beds. Their hands and feet were bound so they couldn't escape. But just in case they might try anything, their captors threw the body of bodybuilder Yosef Romano, mutilated by machine gun fire, into the middle of the room. It was a grim warning.
This intimidation tactic, combined with the murder of their two teammates during the initial ambush, actually likely helped the Israelis. According to a hostage negotiation specialist at UK firm Athena Intelligence, the best way to behave once you've been taken hostage is to be passive and compliant, but not submissive or weak. Hostages who are too aggressive, like both Weinberg and Romano were, are more likely to be killed by their captors.
The remaining nine Israelis realized their best chance of survival was not to cause trouble for the terrorists, not that there was much else they could do.
The terrorists took turns keeping an eye on the hostages. One or two of them, machine guns in hand, were in the room with the Israelis at any given time, while the others spread out around the two-story apartment, keeping an eye on the windows and the situation outside.
While the hostages and their captors waited, the Germans were frantically strategizing how to defuse the situation. At 7:15 a.m., all of the top German officials in the area met at the Olympic Administrative Tower.
In the wake of World War II, the West German government had been structured to avoid repeating the mistakes of the past. After Hitler and the Nazis centralized power at the end of the Weimar Republic, the new West German government in the late 1940s was designed to give the states more control over their own affairs and to make it more difficult for the federal government to intervene. This meant that the federal government would only provide help if officially requested.
Politics being what they are, the Bavarian government was anxious to prove that they didn't need the federal government and could handle this hostage crisis on their own. The tone was set in the first meeting when the Bavarians made it clear to Hans-Dietrich Genscher, the powerful West German federal minister of the interior, and his aide-de-camp Ulrich Wegener, they were only there as advisors. Over the course of the day, Schreiber and the other Bavarian leaders consistently sidelined Genscher and the federal officials, refusing to ask for their help or for federal troops.
But these political maneuvers didn't seem like a problem at first. An emergency task force was set up, directed by Bruno Merk, the Bavarian Minister of the Interior. Everyone agreed that they would start with negotiation rather than force. The Israeli government had been notified, and Prime Minister Golda Meir had immediately made it clear that Israel wouldn't make a deal with the terrorists.
The Germans were on the right track. According to doctors David A. Alexander and Susan Klein, the goal of hostage negotiations is to buy time in order for everyone to calm down and for the authorities to clarify the hostage takers' motives, gather intelligence, and formulate a rescue strategy should negotiations fail.
It also allows the negotiator and hostage taker to build a relationship where the negotiator can help the hostage taker to feel that they're working the problem out together, a key aspect of a successful negotiation process, according to research psychiatrist David A. Soskis and FBI Special Agent Clinton R. Van Zandt.
Though the Germans didn't have a hostage negotiation team, they recognized the importance of having a point person at 31 Connolly Strasse. A 43-year-old policewoman named Annalise Grayus volunteered. She wasn't intimidated by Issa. Over the course of the day, the two developed a rapport. Grayus asked Issa about his actions and motivations, and he seemed to confide in her about his fears.
In retrospect, Annalise Grayus would have been an ideal negotiator. Issa saw her as someone with links to, but not power over, the authorities, which is how Soskis and Van Zandt described the ideal negotiator. But Grayus was never given any negotiating role, and was merely a constant presence throughout the process.
At 8:45 a.m., 15 minutes before the deadline, at which point Issa would start shooting hostages, German officials walked down to 31 Connolly Strasse to talk to Issa in person. Police Chief Schreiber took two men with him, Walter Troger and Ahmed Demirdaş-Towney. Troger was the general secretary of West German National Olympic Committee and the mayor of the Olympic Village. He felt personally responsible for the safety of all athletes. Towney was an Egyptian member of the International Olympic Committee, whom they'd hoped Issa might connect with as a fellow Arab.
Issa came out to meet them, dressed in a khaki suit and pith helmet, his face painted black with shoe polish, holding a hand grenade. Despite this aggressive move, the men found him polite and relatively easy to deal with. His second-in-command, Tony, and the others who kept an eye on them from the windows through the scopes of their machine guns, not so much.
The Egyptian, Towney, started by explaining to Issa in Arabic that the Germans and Israelis were considering the terrorist demands, but they needed more time.
Of course, this wasn't true. The Israelis had already said they had no intention of dealing with terrorists.
Though the Germans thought they were being clever, this was, in fact, a mistake. Psychologist Lawrence Miller says that it's important for a negotiator to strive for honesty and credibility in their dealings with a hostage taker. If the hostage taker feels he's being tricked or manipulated, he's far less likely to cooperate.
At first, though, Issa didn't suspect the Germans of lying and readily agreed to the extension. He'd been prepared for something like this by Abu Iyad and the other Black September leaders. He extended the deadline to noon.
Then Schreiber tried to reason with Issa. On behalf of the German government, he offered Issa and his team unlimited sums of money if they would let the Israeli athletes go free. He and Troger reminded Issa of the genocide of Jews that had happened in Germany during the Holocaust and underscored how anxious they were for no more Jewish blood to be spilled on German soil. They would spend any sum to avoid such an outcome, especially on such an international stage.
But Issa was offended that the Germans would think the Palestinians could be bought off with money. They were fighting for a cause.
This is one of the key mistakes that can be made in dealing with ideological terrorists and hostage takers. According to Soskis and Van Zandt, it's crucial to understand, quote, the individual and group values of those involved in order to create a negotiation strategy that can reduce the risk of violence, end quote.
But the Germans had very little understanding of how politically motivated hostage takers worked or of how to negotiate with the ideological terrorists. This put them at a disadvantage because they didn't understand other ways to satisfy the hostage takers.
after ESA rejected the payoff out of hand, Schreiber and Troeger offered themselves or other German hostages in exchange for the Israeli hostages. Again, ESA dismissed the suggestion as ludicrous.
As they talked, Schreiber eyed ESA. A big man, Schreiber reckoned he could grab ESA and take him hostage, giving the Germans leverage to deal with the other terrorist in the building. But ESA caught Schreiber sizing him up. He held up the hand grenade and threatened to blow them both up if Schreiber tackled him.
Despite all of this, ESA was initially amenable in his dealings with the Germans. He even apologized to Troeger for interrupting the Olympic Games, explaining that they had to take advantage of the international showcase in order to broadcast the plight of the Palestinian Arabs to the rest of the world.
And as the world was waking up and learning of the crisis, that was exactly what was happening.
Good afternoon. I'm speaking to you live just outside the Olympic Village in Munich, West Germany. At this moment, 8 or 9 athletes of the Israeli team are being held prisoner.
All of the international news crews in Munich for the Olympics trained their cameras on 31 Connolly Strasse, broadcasting a live stream of the standoff. Olympic spectators and athletes, as well as Munich locals, started to make their way to the hills, streets, and buildings overlooking the apartment's entrance.
Around 11 a.m., the Israeli government informed the Germans of its official position on the situation. The Israeli government absolutely would not give in to Black September's demands, as they refused to negotiate with terrorists. They trusted the West German government to secure the safe release of the hostages. The Israelis added that they would understand if the terrorists had to go free in order to guarantee the hostages' safety, but they would not exchange prisoners for the hostages.
Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir called it blackmail of the worst kind, explaining, quote, "If we should give in, then no Israeli anywhere in the world can feel that his life is safe," end quote.
With less than an hour to go until noon, at which point ESA had promised to start executing the Israeli athletes, the Germans had no more of a plan than they had 6 hours earlier when they first learned of the attack.
With no other ideas, they recruited Magdi Gohari, an Egyptian advisor to the Arab League, to come to Connolly Strasse to try to reason with ESA. In Arabic, Gohari tried to explain that he didn't believe Israel would give in to Black September's demands. But ESA, a longtime Palestinian fedayeen, trusted neither an Egyptian nor the Arab League, which he regarded as having abandoned the Palestinian Arabs. ESA really seemed to believe their demands would be met, and a baffled Gohari returned to the Germans, having made no further progress.
As the clock ticked closer and closer to noon, the world waited with bated breath to find out if the Israelis would survive. The crisis became a twisted reality TV show, with nearly every television in the world tuned to the hostage negotiations.
Next, we'll find out what happens when ESA finally runs out of patience. Now back to the story. On September 5th, 1972, while the Germans were frantically trying to negotiate, the Israeli hostages inside 31 Connolly Strasse were trying to keep hope alive. They'd been trapped in the bedroom with their dead teammate's body for over 6 hours and had no idea what was happening outside. They didn't know that if a treaty wasn't reached by noon, ESA had told the Germans they'd be killed.
There was less than an hour until this deadline. Still dressed in their underwear and pajamas, they were cold. One of them said as much to one of their young Palestinian guards, and the Black September commando got him a jacket.
This inspired one of the other Israelis, possibly the friendly fencing coach Andre Spitzer. When Jamal Al-Gashay, the youngest terrorist, came into the room to relieve one of his comrades from guard duty, one of the Israelis started chatting with him in Arabic. Before long, they were all telling jokes in Arabic.
ESA must have heard them laughing because he stormed in and broke up the party. He ordered his commandos not to talk to the Israelis because he didn't want them to get too familiar.
From a psychological perspective, this was clever on ESA's part. The hostage negotiation specialist from Athena Intelligence says it's important for hostages to humanize themselves to their captors and to build a rapport in order to make it harder for the hostage takers to kill them. Issa recognized that if his men were joking around with the hostages, it'd be harder to simply treat the Israelis as tools, and it would be harder to kill them if need be.
And with the noon deadline approaching, it looked like Issa might finally go through with his threat to start shooting Spitzer and his teammates.
At 11:45, Munich Police Chief Schreiber and the Egyptian Olympic Committee member Towney returned to ask Issa for another extension. Towney said the telephone lines to Tel Aviv weren't good and that it was taking longer than anticipated to get the whole Israeli cabinet together.
For the first time, Issa started to feel like the Germans were messing with him.
One more hour, he decided. The Germans had until 1 o'clock to demonstrate real progress, or else Issa would personally shoot two of the Israeli hostages outside the apartment building for all the news cameras to see.
Schreiber begged for more time and for flexibility, but Issa was adamant.
When Schreiber returned to the command center, he asked Genscher, the West German Minister of the Interior, and Merck, the Bavarian Minister of the Interior, if they would go to negotiate. Maybe their important positions would impress Issa. Both readily agreed.
Ulrich Wegener, Genscher's aide-de-camp, who subsequently founded Germany's anti-terrorism squad, says this was a huge mistake. In a hostage negotiation, the hostage taker should never have access to the actual decision makers. According to Wegener, the negotiator should always have a higher authority that they have to get permission from and report to. Dr. Justin Borowski says that this allows the negotiator to align themselves with the hostage taker, creating the impression that they too are stuck in a predicament and need the hostage taker to help them.
But the Germans didn't know better, so they sent several high-level officials to talk to Issa. The Black September leader was apparently impressed enough that he agreed to extend the deadline to 3 p.m., guaranteeing the hostages 2 more hours to live. But he wouldn't budge on any of the rest of his demands.
Genscher again reminded Issa of the Holocaust. He and the rest of the German government would do anything in their power to avoid Jewish people being harmed again in Germany. He asked to be exchanged for the 9 Israelis and be held in their place. Genscher was a significant figure who could get them leverage, but Issa again refused. He had his orders and he was sticking to them. He would wait for the prisoners to be released.
Inside the apartment, the hours were stretching on. Spitzer, Goodfriend, and the other hostages hadn't eaten since they'd been wakened by the gunman before 5 a.m., so Issa decided to ask the Germans to bring food. He demanded enough for 20 people, keeping the Germans in the dark as to the number of terrorists.
Schreiber and his team saw a chance to get more intel. At 2:18, he and Troger walked to 31 Connolly Strasse with two police officers dressed as chefs, carrying 4 large boxes of food between them. The chef costumes were almost comical, complete with large white toques, but if they got the officers inside the apartment, it would pay off.
But Issa was far too paranoid to fall for the amateurish plan. He made Schreiber and Troger eat from the boxes of food to prove it wasn't poisoned or drugged, then carried the boxes inside himself.
Half an hour later, 15 minutes before the new 3 p.m. deadline, the Germans returned. This time, Merck, the Bavarian Secretary of the Interior, was the one to ask for another extension. He could tell that Issa was losing patience, so he tried a different tactic and pretended to be frank about the whole thing.
Merck told Issa that the Israelis still hadn't managed to get all the prisoners' files and that the Germans had nothing definite to tell him. He said, quote, "If you want to murder the Israelis you are holding, we can do nothing to stop you. Whether you shoot 1 or 5 several minutes from now, nothing will be changed," end quote.
This tactic might have worked had it been the attitude taken at the beginning of the negotiation, as it would have created the impression that the Germans were a negotiating body trying to work together with the terrorists to achieve a favorable outcome. The Israeli government would have then played the role of the authority that the Germans were reporting to.
But coming this late in the day, nearly 10 hours into the hostage situation, Merk's tactic only served to enrage Issa. He immediately threatened to kill a hostage in 5 minutes if there was no development.
This threat sent Merk back to the command center, where he quickly recruited Mohamed Mestiri, the Tunisian ambassador to West Germany, and Mohamed Khadif, the head of the Arab League in Bonn, to help him deal with Issa. The two Arabs begged Issa to give Israel more time, and Mestiri begged the younger man to show the world that Palestinians were not eager to become killers.
Frustrated, Issa agreed to extend the deadline once again, now to 5 p.m., but he had realized by this point that the Germans were just buying time. He couldn't trust them to deal fairly with him and worried they were planning an ambush.
During the next couple hours, however, it's possible that an agreement was nearly reached. Abu Ayyid, the Black September commander and mastermind of the Munich operation, claimed a peaceful resolution was almost agreed upon that afternoon, though it's worth noting he's the only one to claim this.
The plan was that the hostages would be freed and replaced by German volunteers, who would be taken by the Black September team to an Arab country in order to guarantee their safe departure. A few months later, Israel would discreetly release 50 Palestinian prisoners.
Upon being informed of this plan, Issa wanted to confirm that the Black September commanders were on board. He followed the protocol he'd been given to call a number in Tunisia, where a person, codenamed Talal, would be able to communicate with him through code and let him know the commander's preferences.
However, Abu Iyad claimed the person Issa was trying to reach had been delayed upon arrival in Tunisia, in a move that proved the Germans weren't the only ones somewhat inept at planning. The person who did answer the phone happened to also be named Talal. Of course, he had no idea what Issa was talking about because of the code.
Confused and paranoid, Issa decided he had no choice but to reject the proposal.
Around 4:30 p.m., Issa told the German team that he wanted to take the hostages to Cairo in order to deal with the situation there.
According to Jamal al-Gashay, the Black September commanders had instructed them to try to get the hostages out of Germany if Israel wasn't cooperating. The goal was to get themselves and the hostages to an influential Arab country with good relations with the West, like Egypt or Morocco, with the hope of being able to negotiate for the release of the prisoners through that country's government.
And so Issa demanded that the Germans have 2 airplanes ready to take all of them to Cairo within the hour. He added that if Israel didn't have the Palestinian prisoners waiting in Cairo upon their arrival, his team would execute the hostages.
As far as the Germans were concerned, they couldn't allow the athletes, who had come to Germany as invited guests, to be abducted from their country. Again, Genscher begged to be exchanged for the Israelis, and again, Issa refused.
Finally, Genscher said it would be difficult to get 2 planes with volunteer crews on such short notice. Issa came down to 1 plane, which would be ready by 7 p.m.
The Germans said they'd only agree to the plan if they could see and speak to the hostages and make sure they were willing to leave the country with the terrorists.
After a moment, Issa had Andre Spitzer brought to the second-story window above the pedestrian street where the negotiations were happening. The 53-year-old sharpshooting coach, Kehat Shor, stood behind him.
A crowd of nearly 80,000 spectators, as well as television viewers around the world, watched the slim Spitzer, clad only in his shirt and underwear, hands tied behind his back, lean out to talk to the officials below. His fluent German was polite and calm.
Genscher asked if everyone was okay and what the situation with the other hostages was. Spitzer replied, "Everybody is okay except for one." Presumably, he meant Romano, who'd been killed in the morning. But just then, one of Spitzer's captors hit him with the gun to make him shut up. After a moment, Spitzer was allowed to resume, saying, "All of the hostages who survived the Dawn attack are alive and in fair condition."
Feeling desperate, Genscher cried out, "We are doing everything we can to get you released." Before he could respond, Spitzer was pulled back inside and the curtains closed.
Not having had any of his questions answered, Genscher demanded to speak to the hostages face to face. He told Issa it was the only way they could allow the terrorist and hostages to leave German soil, leaving Issa little choice but to agree.
At 5 p.m., Issa escorted Genscher and Troeger into the apartment.
They walked upstairs to a door guarded by two machine gun-toting commandos. Inside, the situation appalled them. Romano's corpse still lay in the middle of the room, and the 9 surviving men were struggling to keep morale up.
Genscher asked if the men would be willing to leave the country with their captors, if their safety could be guaranteed. The Israelis said yes, since that outcome seemed far better than dying.
The only one who seemed able to keep his spirits up was André Spitzer. Before the Germans left, he gave Genscher a message for his wife. He asked Genscher to tell her not to worry, that he was sure the whole ordeal would end peacefully, and that they'd be together again soon and able to laugh about the whole thing.
Genscher and Troeger were both shaken by the encounter. Again, Genscher begged Issa to take him instead. Again, Issa was unmoved.
As soon as the men left the building, they were hustled off to the command center to be debriefed by the police. The Germans had no intention of letting the hostages be taken out of the country and were finally starting to plan a risky armed rescue mission. In order to do that, they needed to know how many terrorists Genscher and Troeger had seen inside. Between them, the two men decided there were probably 4 or 5 terrorists in total.
The Munich police force's plan was daring. They'd have a dozen officers wearing tracksuits over their bulletproof vests try to sneak in through the building's ventilation shafts. From there, they'd storm the apartment. Next, we'll follow the daring mission to storm 31 Connollystrasse. Now, back to the story. Shortly after 5 p.m. on September 5, 1972, Munich police sent a team up to the roof of 31 Connollystrasse, where Palestinian terrorists had taken 11 Israeli athletes hostage. The officers waited for the code word, sunshine. At that sign, the team would enter through the ventilation shafts and attempt to storm the apartment.
The team consisted mostly of members of the Munich police branch that dealt with organized crime, as they were trained in hand-to-hand combat. The rest of the team consisted of anyone else in the department comfortable shooting a gun.
The entire world watched the police officers enter the Olympic Village and quietly scale the building, courtesy of the non-stop TV broadcast. The tens of thousands of spectators surrounding the building watched nervously, with people yelling instructions and encouragement to the officers.
Issa and the Black September team could tell something was up. They kept looking out of the windows and balconies.
For their part, the officers were sure it was a suicide mission. They had little insight into where the terrorists were in the labyrinth building, and they had no idea what kind of negotiations were happening on the ground below.
Finally, Issa ran outside and threatened to personally kill 2 of the hostages if the police weren't removed. Schreiber called the operation off.
How had Issa known? It turned out that all the athletes' rooms had televisions in them, so the terrorists had watched live as the police scaled the building and waited on the roof for the signal. Chancellor Brandt still hoped to find a peaceful solution. He reached out to the Egyptian government in the hopes that they might help if the Germans let the terrorists take the Israeli hostages to Cairo. But the Egyptian prime minister couldn't absolutely guarantee the hostages' safety, and Brandt couldn't hand over responsibility of the athletes without that guarantee.
So the Germans' only recourse was to appear to agree to Issa's demands for an airplane. It was risky, but the Germans were running out of options.
By 6 p.m., Schreiber and the Germans had a new plan. The terrorists and hostages would be transferred to the airport, and then a rescue attempt would be made there.
Initially, the plan was to use the main Munich airport, though they worried they would put civilians at risk. But then, Troeger reminded them that there was a Luftwaffe airfield, known as Fürstenfeldbruck, about 12 miles outside Munich. There would be plenty of space, and the public wouldn't be endangered.
Once they'd landed at first in Feldbruck, Isa and Tony would go to inspect the jet that was supposed to take them out of the country. At that moment, the German team would attack, taking out the terrorists and rescuing the hostages. A senior police officer was in charge of sourcing the jet, and five police marksmen left to get in position at the airport.
Around 6:35 p.m., the Germans told Isa their plan to fly his team and the hostages to the airport by helicopter, where a plane would take them to Cairo. They just needed more time to get the plane.
Isa had had enough. No more delays. Genscher threw up his hands, similarly fed up. Isa could kill all the hostages right then, Genscher said, but they would still need 2 hours to prepare the plane. Isa reluctantly agreed to a 9 p.m. deadline.
By 7:20 p.m., the Germans had the military helicopters ready and waiting in a field in the Olympic Village.
Around 8:30 p.m., the Germans realized that in order to get to the helicopters, the terrorists would have to walk the Israeli hostages through 650 feet of parking garage tunnels. This would provide the perfect opportunity for an ambush. One of the helicopters was sent to the airfield to get the five snipers so they could take up new positions in the dark garage.
At 8:50 p.m., the Germans finally told Isa they had had everything in place. But when Isa learned they'd have to walk through the parking garage, he demanded to inspect the route. As soon as he stepped into the garage, he realized it was far too dark, the perfect place for an ambush. He demanded a bus to take his team and the Israelis to the helicopters.
It took the Germans until 9:30 p.m. to get a 16-seat minibus to the basement door of the building. But Isa said it was too small.
While the Germans tried to find a larger bus and a willing driver with the right license, the five snipers flew back to Fürstenfeldbruck to resume their positions.
In the meantime, the terrorists prepared. The Black September leaders had thought this through and warned them of the possibility of an ambush when moving the hostages to the aircraft. They would take the hostages in small groups in order to minimize the possibility of escape as well as to protect themselves.
Finally, at 10 p.m., a dark green bus pulled up. One of Isa's crew came out, gun drawn, to check the underground parking garage was clear. Then they brought the Israelis out, blindfolded and in groups of three, and loaded them onto the bus.
10 minutes later, the bus pulled away.
Tens of thousands of spectators and the world's news cameras watched the bus arrive at the helicopters. Isa thoroughly inspected each helicopter before motioning to his team to bring out the hostages. The world watched as Jews were once again held captive in Germany, optics the Germans had wished to avoid from the start.
But the Germans saw something else that scared them. There were 8 terrorists rather than 5. And they only had 5 snipers at Fürstenfeldbruck.
As the helicopters took off, the Germans, the Black September terrorists, and the Israeli hostages all started to feel that everything was about to go wrong. The Germans were finally realizing that their planning was off. The terrorists felt it was all too easy and that it must be a trap. And the hostages were terrified, caught in the middle of a tremendous amount of firepower at the mercy of men who'd murdered 2 of their friends.
The German team at Fürstenfeldbruck had been preparing their ambush for hours. A Boeing 727 was idling on the tarmac, manned by a small crew of police officers disguised as Lufthansa employees. When Isa and Tony would come to inspect it, the officers on the plane would take them down.
Meanwhile, the 5 snipers were positioned around the field.
When the officers on the plane acted, the snipers outside would shoot the remaining terrorists. The plan hinged on the snipers being able to take out all of the terrorists within seconds of each other.
As the helicopters approached, the plan started to go awry. First, the team on the ground still had no idea there were 8 rather than 5 terrorists. No one had informed George Wolf, the Munich deputy chief police, who was running the operation. But even if he had known, Wolf wouldn't have been able to tell the snipers on the ground, as the team had no walkie-talkies.
The snipers were woefully ill-equipped. They had neither telescopic sights nor infrared sights for night vision, and their guns' barrels weren't long enough to ensure accuracy over the distance they were shooting. None of them had bulletproof vests or helmets either.
With just minutes to go, the officers, disguised as plane crew, realized they were on a suicide mission. There were 16 of them, which was a suspiciously large crew for so small a jet. They also didn't have enough Lufthansa uniforms, so some of them were just wearing Lufthansa shirts with their police-issued pants. If the terrorists got suspicious and tossed a grenade into the plane, they'd all be trapped.
When they realized that the plane held enough fuel for a flight to Cairo, meaning a shootout could very easily lead to the plane's explosion, the men started to panic. The captain put it to a vote, and officers abandoned the plane just minutes before the helicopters were due to land.
The captain hurried to report to Deputy Chief Wolf that they'd need a backup plan, but there wasn't time.
The situation only worsened as the helicopters landed at Fürstenfeldbruck around 10:40 p.m. En route, the terrorists had gotten increasingly anxious. Why was it taking so long to get to the airport? Where were the other planes? In their planning, they'd assume they'd be taken to the public airport, and Fürstenfeldbruck obviously wasn't that. They yelled at the pilots to hurry up, convinced they were walking into a trap of some sort.
The pilots set the helicopters down, and Issa got out, nervous. The three other Fedayeen in his helicopter followed him. Tony and the three more junior commanders in the other helicopter got out of theirs after a signal from Issa.
The snipers immediately realized the helicopters had been landed out of position. This put one of the snipers on the ground in his colleague's line of fire, while the snipers on top of the tower didn't have a clear view into the helicopters. The choppers were also closer to the airplane than planned, leaving less space where Tony and Issa would be exposed as they crossed the tarmac.
Issa had promised that the helicopter crews could walk away once they'd landed the helicopters. But as they started to leave, Issa and Tony waved their guns at the men, indicating that they should stay by their aircraft. The German officials were livid that the terrorists now had four more hostages.
Issa and Tony climbed up the stairs of the 727 to inspect it, though it had no crew. The two Fedayeen spent a couple minutes inspecting it for soldiers or booby traps, but upon finding nothing, clearly knew it was a trap. How could they be expected to fly the plane to Cairo without a pilot?
The two men ran back down the stairs of the plane and across the tarmac towards the helicopters, shouting and waving at their comrades.
Without walkie-talkies, the snipers' plan hinged on Wolf giving the order to fire in person to the snipers atop the tower. The two snipers on the ground were told to open fire on their targets as soon as the others did.
As they watched Issa and Tony heading back to the helicopters, the snipers could finally see all eight terrorists and knew they couldn't take them out all at once. They also knew that now was the moment to fire if they were going to attempt the ambush. Wolf gave the order to the snipers on the roof to fire.
The two terrorists guarding the helicopter pilots were shot, and chaos broke out. The helicopter pilots sprinted for safety. Issa and Tony dodged bullets as they raced for the safety of the helicopters. The terrorists swept the field and the buildings with their machine gun fire. On the second floor, the officials watching the operation dove for cover as bullets shattered the windows. Everyone was firing wildly and blindly, hoping that they'd hit the right guys.
After 10 minutes of shooting, the airfield settled into a tense standoff. Only then did someone in German command realize they'd forgotten to call for backup. They'd left a bunch of armored cars at the Olympic Village with the intention of having them follow the helicopters to Fürstenfeldbruck. They'd called the cars, hoping for the best.
Of course, the armored cars got stuck in traffic, caused by tens of thousands of curious civilians driving out to the airfield.
The whole world had been hanging on the edge of this story and wasn't about to stop for lack of information. A rumor started to circulate that the hostages had been rescued in a shootout between the police and the terrorists. Everyone wanted to believe it, while in reality, the German police were still stuck in a standoff, trying to wait out the terrorists until backup arrived.
Just after 11:30 p.m., Reuters ran a wire saying that all the hostages had been freed. Chancellor Brandt couldn't get any news from the field, but the pressure was on for him to make a statement. Rather than risk himself, he sent his press secretary, Conrad Ahlers, on to ABC News to say, quote, "As far as we can see now, this police action was successful," end quote.
The world breathed a sigh of relief as the hostages' family started to celebrate.
What they didn't know was that, at the same time, backup was finally arriving at First and Feldbrook. The armored cars pulled into position at midnight, nearly 20 hours into the crisis.
The terrorists, sure they were about to be mowed down, decided to make their deaths count. Issa started firing madly on the buildings, while one of the others jumped into the helicopter closest to him and machine gunned the men inside. David Berger, Zeev Friedman, Eliezer Halfin, and Yaakov Springer. As he jumped out, he threw a grenade in, the helicopter exploding moments later.
As Issa and another terrorist were finally taken out by the rooftop snipers, one of the others jumped into the second helicopter and shot the remaining five hostages. Andre Spitzer, Kehat Shor, Amitzer Shapira, Yosef Gutfriend, and Mark Slavin. Their screams were audible even in the control tower.
The remaining terrorists made a break for it, the armored cars and snipers pursuing. The police chased Jamal Al-Ghashay, his uncle Adnan, and Mohammed Safadi through the woods for nearly an hour before catching and arresting them.
Not until all the police were back at the airfield and First and Feldbrook was secured did the firemen finally put out the fire caused by the grenade in the first helicopter. Unsure if all the terrorists were dead, they'd been afraid to put out the fire before the airfield was secure. By the time they put it out, all the hostages and five of the eight terrorists were dead.
It turned out, though, that had they put out the fire as soon as they could have, they would have saved David Berger's life. The American hostage had only been shot in the leg and had survived the explosion. A post-mortem showed he died of smoke inhalation in the subsequent fire.
At 3:17 a.m., Reuters finally corrected its statement, and ABC anchor Jim McKay announced to the world that all the hostages had died.
There were 11 hostages. Two were killed in their rooms yesterday morning. Nine were killed at the airport tonight. They're all gone. The Israeli Olympic team was destroyed, much of it, some of their officials.
The Munich hostage crisis and massacre had reverberations for decades to follow. The Germans' abject failure in both hostage negotiations and anti-terrorism served as a harsh wake-up call for the rest of the world.
Ulrich Wegener, Genscher's aide-de-camp, promptly founded Germany's elite anti-terror unit, learning from the lessons of September 5, 1972. The lessons he and others learned showed how the Bavarian officials did almost everything wrong from the beginning of the negotiation process, from not securing the area to not having a designated negotiator to making the hostage takers feel isolated and antagonized.
The violent outcome also set a standard to avoid for hostage negotiations around the world. Now the use of force is avoided at almost all costs, as experts recognize the high likelihood that the hostages will become collateral damage. The world also realized that ideological terrorists needed to be handled in a different way from other terrorists and hostage takers.
The Israeli government chose to respond by spending the next few decades chasing down the surviving terrorists and anyone else involved with Black September who could have had a hand in planning the raid. Though it's worth noting that they didn't entirely succeed and seemed to have assassinated a few people who had nothing to do with the incident or Black September. Israel also came down even harder on the Palestinian Arabs, believing that if the people were punished, that would discourage others from joining Black September's fight.
These attacks from the Israelis had the opposite effect. Instead of discouraging Palestinian Arabs from fighting against the Israelis, the retribution actually radicalized more young people.
But Black September itself petered out within a few years of the Munich massacre. Despite devastating loss of life, Black September achieved its goal of making the world aware of the Palestinians' plight. Now that people were paying attention, the Black September leaders felt there was far less need for dramatic attacks, and the PLO would be better served through dialogue and diplomacy.
As for the families of both the murdered Israeli athletes and the slain terrorists, they all just want peace. They feel there's been enough bloodshed, and while forgiveness is hard for the children of some of the Israeli athletes, they all want to be able to move forward to a less violent, more understanding future for Israel and Palestine.
You can listen to Hostage and all of Parcast's other podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, CastBox, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast directory. If you enjoy the podcast, please leave a 5-star review while you're there. It's the best way to help us keep going.
We'll be back next week.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted. Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Joel Stein and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Hostage is written by Kate Thorman and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.